Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle, and today we have two special guests, and they're here to talk about their Kickstarter campaign, 13th Age in Glorantha. And the title pretty much describes the two elements that it combines. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. This is Jeff Richard. I'm the creative director for Moon Design and the lead author for The Guide to Glorantha and a whole slurry of other Glorantha-related products. And Rob needs no introduction, but I guess he'll go ahead and do it anyways.
Sure. I'm Rob Hainso, the guy who pronounces Glorantha is how what I always say wrong. And I am, you know, Jeff and I both get to use that word creative director. Isn't that a cool title?
It really is.
Like, yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's not quite as good as High Shaman or Glorious August Muckety Muck. But
so the great part is when you're creative director at companies like ours, like mine, Fire Opal Media, and yours, Moon Design, what it also means is that you and I are the people who definitely, if we don't want to, don't have to handle the business tasks.
Nice.
Exactly.
Am I right?
Woohoo! Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and other people sometimes on the company roll their eyes and refer to us as the talent. So there we are.
The divas.
You know, try not to be. So, in on this project, we're the game designers, on the book, Jeff did The Guide to Glorantha recently as a wonderful thing on Kickstarter, and Jonathan Tweet and I went ahead and did 13 True Ways for 13th Age as a Kickstarter before 13th Age had even come out. So
right.
We've both had recent Kickstarter campaigns, and now we're doing another one together.
Right. So tell us about 13th Age in Glorantha, or as you call it, Rob, 13G. So yeah, you guys have both done previous successful Kickstarters. What's the elevator pitch here? What is 13th Age in Glorantha?
And Rob, I'm actually going to ask you to take the first jump at this, and then I will come at it from a different direction.
You know, my friends like to mock me because I'm a person who hates explanations. And so whenever they really want to like hit me with something, they say, hey man, tell me about the elevator pitch. I think the elevator pitch for this game is that it's taking the indie-style D20 storytelling RPG 13th Age and bringing it into the mythologically rich and powerful storytelling world of Glorantha. And I think that the elevator pitch that I just gave you is interesting in this sense. It's a pitch that really works for people who know either 13th Age or Glorantha. And I honestly, you know, even when we're doing the Kickstarter, I have not been, you know, working extremely hard to be like explaining the project to people who know neither. And therefore, that could be, you know, elevator pitches aren't that great for that when you have a project that's combining two things that did not know each other beforehand. So for people who know one or the other, it's a good pitch. For people who don't know either, well, then we need more explanation, I think.
Right.
At which point I'll jump in.
Yeah.
Because Glorantha is one of the, I'd say it's one of the foundational fantasy settings, in RPGs. Certainly one of the most influential, fantasy settings, kind of the velvet underground of fantasy settings, in that, almost every Glorantha fan at one time or another seems to have become a game designer. am I wrong, Rob?
That's a very funny joke. I hadn't heard it, and I totally understand what you mean. Yeah, that's good. Nice.
And but Glorantha is unbelievably rich, unbelievably mythological, mythic fantasy setting that's been around for now in game form in one way or another for over 40 years, and as in a literary form, almost 50 years.
Wow.
And from our perspective, or from my perspective, what 13th Age in Glorantha does is give us a new way to explore this setting. Because previously, you know, the ways that you've been able to explore Glorantha has been through the old Dragon Pass board game, through RuneQuest, through HeroQuest, through the computer game King of Dragon Pass. And 13th Age gives us a new way and a new vehicle to be able to explore the setting in a way that hasn't been done before. And 13th Age is from...
And that path is kind of wonderfully ironic. I'll cut in here. I mean, when I was a kid, I started playing D&D in 74. And I more or less seriously stopped playing D&D, I admit, when RuneQuest came out. RuneQuest came out, I think it was, 78? And
78.
RuneQuest was a pretty amazing game in terms of its sort of maturity and the mechanics it offered from the very start. And
you could play a werepig.
Yeah, well, I didn't. Yeah, I don't think I had the maturity to take advantage of all the options. But it was a fantastic game, and I started playing it instead, basically, and so did Jonathan. Now, all these years later, our sort of technological skill as game designers and the games we, Jonathan and I, like to play together, you know, we've gone ahead and been in the same gaming group for, I think, around 15 years now. Wow. Jonathan and I have been playing on Wednesday nights. And so 13th Age is the game we wanted to play together. You know, we're pretty comfortable with the Dungeons and Dragons style D20 rolling experience. And we now have the sort of savvy of understanding of how we could apply it to Glorantha, a world that didn't, you know, has never been part of that tradition. So when Jeff says, oh, well, it's a new way to play and experience it, you know, we're actually making character classes, which has, you know, Glorantha has never had character classes, mm-hmm. you know, not in any of its games. And, you know, and we're finding out the ways in which hero questing, you know, the wonderful sense in which Glorantha and heroes and player characters, if they're not quite heroes yet, go back and relive alongside or against the gods, the mythological moments that create or destroy the world. Well, we can look at that as sort of like myth crawling, where characters are going into a myth instead of going into a dungeon, and the pieces of the strange, arbitrary god time world are, you know, sort of akin to the living dungeons that might hit you in 13th Age, where the logic isn't entirely there. It's a different mythological logic. And so the connections between the worlds, well, it's going to be pretty rich. And there are things that we're coming up with that will be new to, that's a topic we'll talk about, but, the exciting thing for me and Jonathan is that Glorantha, of course, contributes all these new elements, and that means we get to make up new ideas that will then filter right back into 13th Age. And so the system is going to change and improve, and people will be able to use that in other games too.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, okay, how was that for the elevator pitch?
That was
we have no questions left.
I know. Yeah.
I think what I have to do is I just realized it. Thank you, Jeff. That's my metaphor from now on. It's like as I start giving the elevator pitch, I'm going to reach out and hit the little alarm button, and then the elevator gets stuck in between the floors.
Exactly.
And I'm like, nope, don't go anywhere. It's still happening.
So, like you said, Glorantha's history goes back to the mid-70s as a game, at least, and then the 60s as a literary form. How would you describe the setting for those players not familiar with it?
Okay, in a nutshell, it's a Bronze Age setting where the fundamentals of reality are mythology. Glorantha really is flat. The sky really is a dome. The sun really does come out of the eastern gates every morning, the gates of dawn, roll its way across the sun dome until it gets to the other side of the dome and enters into the western gates of dusk, and then goes down into the underworld and passes through the realm of the dead, only to return at the end of the night or the beginning of the day, depending on your perspective, back at the gates of dawn. I mean, that is the physical reality of the world. It's not a world based on physics. It's a world that's built out of its own myth. And the mythology of Glorantha is extremely rich, but at its core is a fairly universal mythological archetypes that if you're familiar with mythology, you'll recognize a lot of the themes, if not the stories. Mm-hmm. Which is the other thing about Glorantha is Glorantha is its own thing. It's not a pastiche of the real world or of some group of historical civilizations in the real world. It's its own set of cultures and peoples and history that makes sense with this mythological basis. And it's been a place for adventuring and for gaming for 40 years. And is certainly the favorite setting of quite a lot of people that have been involved in game design. Not just myself. It's certainly one of Rob and Jonathan's favorite settings. It's a favorite setting of Sandy Peterson. And it's a favorite setting of Ken Rolston, who was the developer of Morrowind. You know, it's this setting that's been popular with a pretty wide range of people within the hobby. And
hey Jeff, can I step in and play off with something you said about why that's true? So one reason I think why it is what its power is mm-hmm. that when you have a world that is mythologically true rather than the physics, there are different gods. And when you first encounter Glorantha, you tend to like get the perspective of, say, the air gods, Orlanth, the Storm King. And when people read those stories and understand, they're like, oh, yeah, that makes total sense. I get it. Orlanth is the hero. He fought the emperor here. He killed the emperor, but then he got him back from hell on this big quest. That's really powerful, and I get it. And later on, like, or soon, you find the mythology of, the emperor's side, or say the trolls who were in hell when the sun came down and burned them, or the people who are the enemies of Orlanth, the Lunars, who worship a goddess a chaos goddess who jumped into the world. All of those perspectives make sense. They all make sense, and they all tell a really compelling story about how the people that are telling them are, if not the center of the universe, are definitely the protectors of what's good in the universe. Mm-hmm. And they're all in competition. And they're all somehow true. I mean, the God Time...
Not somehow true. They're all true.
They're all true. Yes.
And they're also all contradictory.
And they're all contradictory. And when, you know, as a kid, when I encountered that, it actually kind of blew my mind. and it kind of changed my life, honestly. So but for gaming perspective, what happens then is that you don't have a world where, we can be pretty sure that the Orc Lord and the Lich King, and even the Crusader are evil. You know, let's just use the word evil. That these guys are evil, and the other guys, they're good. Like this, like Great Gold Worm in 13th Age, he's definitely good. You know, the Emperor, probably good. Well, that isn't the case in Glorantha. The words good and evil, I mean, you could apply them to individual people, you know, for sure, but it's not part, there's no alignment system. There's the gods you worship, the stories they lived are the way you try to live. And when you do that, there's certain things that you will do that, that maybe the other people, the other pantheons think is terrible. But you're living according to your lights, and it's the perspective on how everybody is part of creation, but then sometimes are against each other is very, very powerful. I think, for instance, there was I just got a copy of a book sent to me by Penny Love, The Widow's Tale. And it's a wonderful book telling the story of these two separate, I guess, units of soldiers and the tragedy, you know, that like unfolds as they're both completely living according to like the style of their god. That's a powerful piece of Glorantha. And the storytelling it opens up for us is going to be really strong because we get to like play with characters from all different pantheons who are unified fighting chaos. That's going to be sort of the bottom line story, but it will make for a lot of interesting role playing at the table.
Definitely sounds like it will.
Mm-hmm. Anything else on that, Jeff? Because I know I jumped in.
Oh no, I mean it's the mythology of Glorantha that I think almost everybody would agree that's what drives the attraction to it. It's a wonderful thing to be able to, you know, in fantasy. The connection between fantasy and mythology is very porous. But unfortunately, in a lot of fantasy writing and a lot of fantasy gaming, it's the mythology that unfortunately gets the short shrift. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we as storytellers, as human beings, we can't help but create mythology. And Glorantha, one of the things that's interesting about Glorantha is that because that's the founding principle of it, the ability to have these sort of fantastic, mythic, epic feeling tales and tragedies and stories is just unbelievably rich.
So I think I should, let me say something about that. I think there's the power of Glorantha mythology is huge. And what our goal is with 13th Age and Glorantha is that we are making as much of it playable as possible.
Yes.
When we tell a myth, it's not just going to be text with the story of the myth. And, you know, Glorantha fans have seen some of these myths before. They're going to be the familiar myth of, you know, the Lightbringer's quest, of how Orlanth ended up killing Yelm, more or less accidentally. And then, spoiler alert there, sorry. And then after, with a crazy band of motley cast-off fools, manages to get to hell and bring the sun back. Well, when we put that...
If you listen to that, you know, just as quick aside there, that's a fairly universal story. I mean, if you just went and saw Guardians of the Galaxy, there's elements of that story in there. And that's one of the things about Glorantha mythology is that even if you don't know Glorantha myth, you'll recognize some of these themes and some of these stories. Sorry.
Yeah, we have to work to bring that out, because I think that sometimes newcomers especially cannot see the giant forest because of the incredible convoluted trees. But we'll work on that. So in 13th Age and Glorantha, what's going to happen is that myth will be appearing with essentially, call them quest stations, or you could think myth-crawling dungeon rooms, mm-hmm. Well, corresponding to elements of the quest, sliced inside of it, like on the page, so that as you read, you can skip the game material and just read the story, or you could like look at the game material at the same time to find the basic outlines of the myth quest that your characters could take, could go on. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, when you brought up myth crawling and dungeon crawling, dungeon crawling is a type of a myth. You know, what you're doing whenever you do a dungeon crawl is you're doing your story is it's a trip into the underworld. You know, you go you enter the dungeon, you go down into the darkness. You trek through the underworld, overcoming guardians and obstacles until you find whatever the boon you're looking for in the underworld and returning back with it.
I'm laughing. I have this huge smile on my face because I like it. I'm like, Professor Richard. Yes, it's true. It's true.
It's true. What we're doing with myth crawling. I mean, not to denigrate dungeon crawling, but one is it's just one of the types of myths that are traditionally associated with fantasy or with ancient or heroic mythology. Hmm. But the other thing about it is that, you know, in the dungeon.
Yeah, I get what you say. Yeah, there'll be different types of quote adventure that will be part of the myth crawling. I think that the fun we're going to have is, you know, the dungeon crawling has its own power now.
Yep.
As a separate mythic activity in our gaming culture. We are going to harness that and use it as a interesting avenue to get people playing powerful myths and basically learning about, you know, people can be learning about the world and helping recreate it while playing is
yep.
basically the way that's going to happen. And
having some really, really cool adventures that play around with some powerful themes that are pretty universal in our storytelling.
One fun part of 13th Age and Glorantha is that we are going to be tackling a couple, like thanks to the stretch goals, we're going to do the trolls, the dark trolls, the Uz, came out of hell as a playable race. Now, what that means in 13th Age terms
poor,
is...
poor, tragic, man-eating monsters of darkness.
Yeah, I know. It's like, I haven't done a full job of introducing them to people, you know, but they are... Their teeth are built for eating flesh, and they're not really, you know, they don't care at all who's... Or anything else. They'll eat anything. And we have to do new myths for them. You know, from a 13th Age perspective, we're going to do a very interesting class that involves all the different troll gods and powers from those gods as part of the class. From a Glorantha perspective, we have to do, you know, we haven't, there's a few troll myths, but there's not enough troll myths with trolls as protagonists. On the, you know, it's like they show up as, oh yeah, and then we kill the trolls, you know, but that's not exactly what we need. And so the fun part is we're going to be doing some new myths that show the trolls as protagonists, and that the way that events in our sort of default storyline go, where the chaos is partially unraveling the world and everybody needs to cooperate with different pantheons in order to deal with that, is that we have the possibility that people from the Storm Pantheon and the Earth Pantheon and who worship death are going to be going with a troll on a troll hero quest. And oh, that's going to be fun.
Yep. Part of the thing on this is that the great compromise, during the God time, during the age of mythology, the world was nearly destroyed by chaos. And it was only the willingness of the gods to all come into this great compromise where each of them agreed to only do that which they had already done in mythology. And so that none of them would do anything new. They would be locked into their mythic actions. That's unraveling and letting chaos into the world. And all of the gods ended up uniting and working together despite their runic conflicts or just different areas of power or interest. So will adventuring parties. I mean, this will be, we'll be able to have, you know, adventuring parties with an Orlanthi Windlord and his Rolian Earth Queen, Humakti's Sword, a Zarak-Zaran Deathlord, and now even ducks. Right, Rob?
I saw that's unlocked. Yeah, the Feathered Fury.
Oh, cool.
Yes. It's so funny because as soon as you start talking about ducks, the temptation to turn everything you write as an update into a duck pun is just horrible. And you can't, and you know, as a creator of a project or, you know, maintaining semi-dignity, you have to not do that. But it is, so the ducks are wonderful. They're the comic relief. I would phrase them as the comic relief who actually play a deep, serious role in the world. I think I realized a little while ago during another podcast that in a bizarre sense, you know, you might squint. I don't know if this is what Greg thought at all, but like, you know, wait a minute. They're tiny little people who are entirely peaceful, more or less peaceful, living, not noticed by... Yeah, okay, all right. See, you're going to spoil it. They're not hobbits.
They're not.
Yeah. No, yeah, I'll tell you what.
Spoiler, don't spoil it, Jeff.
No, they're not.
Yes, I know. Half our crowd thinks of the ducks as the worst badass Deathmaster champions of Who Mocked ever. And
everybody who's sane thinks of them as those annoying folk that just happen to be inhabiting really good land, and can't we just get rid of them so that we can move in?
And then it turns out there's a low property values in that wetland.
There are low property values in that wetland.
And a few zombies.
There was a great quote from one of the creators of Howard the Duck, which may or may not have been a big inspiration on Greg introducing ducks into Glorantha back in the 70s.
Well, didn't ducks in Glorantha, didn't ducks predate Howard?
76, 78. When was Howard the Duck created?
Oh, Howard the Duck was earlier than that.
Yeah. So I think it's about that. But there's a great quote that ducks teach us that life's most serious moments and most incredibly dumb moments are often distinguishable only by a momentary point of view.
Nice. Wow. That's good.
I was pretty impressed by that.
We're going to play ducks. We're the straight men with ducks because, you know, they have a place in Glorantha. They have a sort of a function they're fulfilling in a way. They have missions. We're going to have a little adventure involving them. But we don't have to make duck jokes because Lord knows any campaign in which a duck is a player character we'll probably have some.
It's so true.
And, you know, if not, the best duck characters sometimes are the straight men, you know, because you get the duck who's like, I am not like those other people. Mm-hmm. I am a serious warrior and I demand to be treated with dignity.
Spark Fiddler of Umak
Duda. Good luck. Yeah, exactly. Now, there's also going to be Trollkin, of course, in this mix.
And Trollkin are just sad, though. They're just sad. They're so tragic that they're beyond
tragic.
Okay,
Jeff, I'm going to tell you, this is something that Jeff doesn't know. So you know how people, the moment we introduced trolls, there was somebody on the Kickstarter saying, hey, do we get to play a mistress race troll? And the question he's really asking is, do we get to play a superhero troll? Who's just better than everybody in every way? You know, one of somebody who's been alive since like the god time, perhaps,
yeah.
You know.
Yes, but he was born in the underworld.
So the 13th age way to handle this, and that I'm going to experiment with, and I'm pretty sure it's going to work. So you want to play Mistress Race Troll. Hey, that's cool. You totally get to. But guess what? At first level, you're a Trollkin. And you have to play a Trollkin for 4 levels, right? And somewhere in Champion Tier, you get to introduce a Dark Troll who eats that Trollkin, all right? The Trollkin is lunch. Like, that's, the Dark Troll eats it. Now you're playing a Dark Troll.
And so once you finally get to 10th,
at some point,
you get to 10th level and you get to...
We're probably going to let him. No, we're going to let him play Mistress Race Troll longer than just 10th level. 8th or 9th or 10th, somewhere in there. Yeah, you got it.
At your final level, you get to go down into the Castle of Lead where you get eaten by one of the Mistress Race Trolls that live at the bottom there.
Wow. I think I'm going to give them a level or two of playing a Mistress Race Troll because they've sacrificed 2 beloved characters. But yes, this is the troll way. This is what happens. So yeah, so the answer is, you know,
the trolls have. The trolls have a lot of anxiety about, I mean, they're absolutely devoted to the mistress race trolls because they're the mother of everything.
Right.
They're the mother of their species. They're the heads of their religion. They are demigods. But they're also terrified of them because they eat anything. And they have terrible fears that some of the wars and conflicts they have are just an opportunity for the mistress race to be able to get more food.
Right.
So I like that, Rob.
Yeah, I figured you would. That's good. And the answer is, do you get to play Mistress Race Troll? Yes, you do.
That sounds that sounds like a pretty big yes, but.
Oh, I didn't say but. You did. Anyway.
But yeah, the trolls are a wonderful species, and a lot of people consider Call of Cthulhu to be Sandy's greatest contribution to tabletop gaming, but I think it was definitely Troll Pack. But Sandy wrote this amazing, amazing box set back, I think, in 81, 82 called Troll Pack. And it let you play troll characters. And it was completely from the troll's perspective. And the trolls before that, you know, the trolls were just another sentient monster that caused no end of difficulty and had strange, bizarre powers that came out from the underworld and darkness. And after that, they're still exactly that, but you can't help but respect them, or at least feel a little sympathy for their, you know, poor guys. They just want to be able to go back to hell. You know, this world that they live in now, it's a horrible place. Not like hell or Wonder Home.
Yeah, that was good. That was one of the best moments there. I think we can. Yeah. Oh, it's going to be very, very fun because there will be, you know, we're going to be doing hero quests or myth crawls, whatever we want to call them, into Wonder Home. That'll be fun.
Which, if you're a mortal human, you call it hell or the underworld,
right.
Or place of the dead or, you know, demon home. And for the trolls, it's, oh, it's heaven.
That's right. We're
I
back.
Can see that a lot of jokes at the gaming table about that.
Yeah.
This is hell. Yeah. I wish.
Yeah, right.
If only.
So, kind of an overall question about 13th Age, how did that game come about? You mentioned that you'd been playing with Jonathan for some 15 years, and it kind of developed over that time. But, what was the inspiration or the impetus for it?
A long time ago, back before I really got into the gaming industry, I was in touch with Jonathan because we wrote for a fanzine called Alarums and Excursions together. Mm-hmm. I started sending him postcards. And then we ended up corresponding. And so Jonathan later worked at Wizards. When he designed third edition D&D, I was in his home playtest group. So I had been playing third edition D&D for almost a year in a way before anybody else had. Mm-hmm. And so the bizarre part about that was that when I got hired at Wizards of the Coast right after that. And I was the person, even though I was new to the company, I had actually been using the game for a long time and other people had it. So it was kind of a little bit of a jump start that way. That was a great campaign called the Elisandra campaign that he ran. He ran that for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. Later on, then I ended up being lead designer on D&D 4th edition. Mm-hmm. And that meant Jonathan played in my 4th edition game and I played in his 4th edition game. Jonathan actually ran 4th edition a long time. A crazy 9 worlds campaign where the player characters were traveling to all the different planets of the solar system and each one had their own powers and stuff. Oh, cool. That was a lot of fun. And after neither of us worked at Wizards, and I was like, I set up Fire Opal Media with a few other people, and Jonathan and I wanted to make a game together. And Simon Rogers at Pelgrane, at one point I had been talking about doing some work with him, and he had said, hey, look, I'll just publish anything. If you do a new game for me, I'll publish it. And I was kind of like, what, really? and he's like, yeah, whatever you do, I'm sure. It'll be good. And so I talked with Jonathan. We're like, well, what do we want to do? And the answer was, we wanted to make a game that we would want to play together in our gaming group. And it looked like the pretty clear answer was that it was going to be a D20 rolling fantasy game because that's what our group enjoyed playing. Mm-hmm. And we know that there's a market for it. And more than that, we also have the skills to do it and do it well. And there's things that we really wanted to, you know, and so 13th Age is us grabbing things from indie role-playing, creating a more storytelling version of the D20 experience, and really creating the game we want to play together. It was so much fun to do together. And you know, we're still working working on supplements and working on 13th Age and Glorantha for it. And so that's the genesis of how it came about.
I mean, the fantasy genre is really popular and crowded. But so why is 13th Age so popular? How did it stand out? I mean, maybe the names that were on the book certainly helped.
Okay. So it's very odd. The question mark of names on a book helping is a strange one because to some extent, yes. To another extent, it is, there's sometimes a case that shows pretty clearly that a lot of people do not notice names at all on books. You know, the internet crowd does, for example, more, but then people who aren't on the internet, not as much, you know, not really. For instance, my friend Keith Baker can attest to this in a way. It's like Keith does all different styles of games, role-playing games like Eberron and like card games like Gloom and the Doom that came to Atlantic City. And what you would find is that the fans of those various games have no idea that Keith Baker, this guy, did these other things too. Mm. Like, you know, like there's just no recognition across that. So, although that helped, because then we, you know, when I did the elevator pitch for the game, I was pretty much able to like use our names and what our background was as part of that really easily. And so that made it a lot easier. My answer to why do another fantasy game and how could it be successful? I was in a friend's house one time and I saw this just wonderful picture of a Tyrannosaurus Rex exploding off the wall in a poster. And I was like, you know, there is always going to be room for another great painting of a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
On velvet.
Of course, there can never be enough paintings of a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
I agree completely.
And I say that as a person who voted for Triceratops in Jonathan's grandmother
now,
fish.
There's enough pictures of Triceratops.
So. What I liken that to fantasy games. I mean, the fact is that our Western culture right now really prefers fantasy games. The science fiction gaming experience or the horror gaming experience and others, they're there and they can be strong. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that fantasy is the genre that fits. Here's the thing. I could tell you my various theories about why I think that's true, mm-hmm. But I'm not positive. I'm not positive that's exactly what you want to hear. I'll just say that I think
that'll
it is.
That'll be for a follow-up podcast sometime.
Yeah, that's a follow-up. But But it is true, and so there's room for another T-Rex. There's room for another fantasy game. Now, if it's done really, really well, the truth is, we had to, you know, with 13th Age, the responsibility we feel with every single paragraph and every single page mm-hmm. is to not bore the reader. You know, it's like, as an example of this, I fought against having a price list, you know, in the game, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, I don't want a price list. I mean, they're boring. It's like, it's just wasted space. And then I had playtesters again and again say, oh, come on, you have to give us a price list. Mm-hmm. So I did, but then I put in sections that say, okay, we know how much a horse costs. Well, then here's how much a cat costs. Oh, and how about a cat that's guaranteed to be free of demonic possession in Horizon? Well, here's that cost. How about a cat that's guaranteed to be free of demonic possession near the Hellmarsh? Oh, it's a lot more expensive. You know, so then I had to find ways to make the price list entertaining. Now, I think that that attitude is of not, you know, we just want to make everything have some point to it. Carries across in 13th Age to the fact that we're not only trying to make a fantasy game that's worth playing on its own, but we were going to show people other ways they could be playing the games they're already playing. You know, we have no problem if you like the escalation die mechanic that helps battles come to a conclusion faster. Mm-hmm. Please take it. You know, don't play 4th edition without it. You might want to use it in Pathfinder, you know, because it's just a mechanic that helps things. And so, and that's part of the reason why during the book, Jonathan and I will, you know, talk to each other in sidebars and explain, hey man, I think his version of this is not the best, but here's my version. And that's partly because it's a design conversation with the fans. The idea is we're going to give you just the basics of the world and you're going to fill in the rest. And we're going to give you a bunch of mechanics in certain places. Really, it depends on what type of campaign you want to run that determines what campaign, you know, what you should be doing. Mm-hmm. So the book is attempting to be a dialogue, with people. And I think that casual tone that we used is also a bit different, as part of that dialogue.
And Rob, I want to give a call out about 13th Age to the Glorantha hardcore because, you know, 13th Age, you've seen some of the questions that you get from the old school Glorantha fans is, you know, a tremendous amount of the core Glorantha base is been there with RuneQuest and with HeroQuest and really operates in a parallel different universe from D20. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, in my case, I stopped playing first edition D&D about the same time that Rob did and didn't ever come back. And so, you know, for us to take the leap to say, you know, 13th Age is a awesomely cool enough game that we want to have it for Glorantha is saying a lot to a lot of the hardcore Glorantha fans. And we were at Gen Con this year. Yes. And Rob and Neil Robinson from Moon Design and myself and Michael O'Brien, who's one of the big writers for RQ3. He wrote Sun County, Strangers and Cracks, and was really involved in what was called the RuneQuest Renaissance of now 25 years ago.
Right.
And we loved it. We absolutely loved it. And for us, what we saw was, oh yeah, you know, this is making the you know, D20 games, which we can kind of remember, yeah. but we remember it well enough that we can remember the basic concepts, but you know, it's been a long time. Mm-hmm. But what we loved about it is that, hey, you know, this lets us do the sort of style of game and a lot of the sort of things that we do in RuneQuest or in HeroQuest or in Pendragon, or any of those family of games, and doing it in a D20 system, and we're having an awesome time. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're a Glorantha fan that's on the fence about, you know, whether it's a smart idea for there to be another rule system for Glorantha, especially one that's got a D20 base. Mm-hmm. Let me assuage your doubts. This is an awesome, fun game.
I think part of the fun is that you guys, you know, it was the opening scene of a 13th Age campaign. Every player has got, gets to make a one unique thing about their character.
Right.
And, I think that's a familiar enough. The examples of the one unique thing. Let's see, Jeff, your character.
I was a drow, a black elf sorceress.
Yes.
And my one unique thing is I'm the only black elf in the entire setting, because right. What black elves are is they are the blasphemous offspring of a regular elf that is mated with and then was devoured by some
right.
sort of underworld demon.
That's right. And your mother was the Diabolist herself,
oh,
right?
Wow.
Yes, that was good times.
That was Mom.
So,
that'll set the tone for a campaign right there.
That does. No, that's the thing. And you know, Jonathan and I were actually working on One Unique Things on Glorantha yesterday and writing up an awful lot of examples of them. So what happens with the one unique thing is that players immediately tell the game master part of what they want the campaign to be around. And therefore the game master is like, oh, and now I know how to tie plot hooks in there. And the story from the very start gets to be more around what the players are interested in. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of a guidance thing for the game master and a really exciting thing for everybody else. So I think that's one of the things that Glorantha fans will really groove on.
Oh yeah, it fits beautifully with in the HeroQuest Glorantha rule system.
Yep.
We have a thing called the pitch.
Yep.
You basically say, you know, I'm gonna give a one sentence description of, you know, what I'm wanting to play as if I'm an agent talking to a Hollywood actor to play my character, and it can be whatever you want it to be. You know, so it was wonderful to see that sort of player driven creativity in 13th Age. And that had me sold.
I think that in a certain sense, to get back to the root of your question, back when you asked what was the genesis of 13th Age, 13th Age is Jonathan and me creating a game with player-driven storytelling tips and ways that is built into the mechanics of the game so that every combat and every skill roll has aspects of that personal storytelling involved, even though it's happening inside the framework of a D20 rolling game. I admit that as we were doing the game, one of the things that Jonathan and I would talk about was that we would look at each other and say, you know, we could do Glorantha with a system.
Oh, wow, cool.
and part of the, you know, when you, the icons of 13th Age, you know, are taking the things you always find in a Dungeons and Dragons world, fantasy world of like the Archmage, the big, huge wizard, and the Emperor, and the Elf Queen. Mm-hmm. The icons, i.e. gods of Glorantha, are different. But if you call them by their roles, which is to say the Storm King, the Earth Queen, the Death Lord, the Emperor, if you call them by their roles, you find that they're actually, you know, there's more that people can grab onto there that isn't just, the name Yelm for the Emperor. And so part of the transition between the two worlds, it's actually, when we were making up Koru BMS that circle the world and then splash down into the Koru Straits, and we were saying that when the Great Gold Worm is actually inside the abyss holding off the demons, and when there's a giant demon, Gorgon's Maw, sticking above the earth, you know, and hell holes are like burning through the world thanks to the Diabolist, this type of powerful image connected to events in the world that are still having impact, that is what Glorantha is about. And our goal with 13th Age and Glorantha is to get player characters, heroes, interacting with all that cool stuff that's in Glorantha. So for instance, you know, when the fact that the dwarves of Glorantha are, you know, essentially using a giant winch to lever up a continent, which if they succeed, will at some point flood most of the world. Well, you know, when you really at the epic tier of 13th Age of Glorantha, you want to have your campaign be about preventing that or helping it. You know, you're good at that's the point. It's like you get to go ahead and deal with those incredibly cool mythological pieces and do it in a, you know, but on the way you're participating in the style of that of action adventure that is, you know, common in D20 rolling games and fantasy games. And so it's a trip that ends up at different places, using some familiar tools.
So yeah, you guys summed up perfectly why these two games go
together.
Yeah, exactly. Like peanut butter and chocolate. So
exactly.
Were there any initial concerns by putting these two things together?
Oh yeah, of course. You know, one of the just to throw out several. One would be was the question of what the reaction of the Glorantha fan base would be. For us to be supporting a D20 rolling system. I mean, that was Rob. That was something we talked about pretty early on, didn't it?
Oh yeah.
And then another issue is the core setting for 13th Age, the Dragon Empire, is largely it's a heavily blank piece of paper that you and the game master and the players get to fill in all the blank places.
Right.
And initially there were some design concerns because Glorantha, you know, we just wrote an 800 something page encyclopedia of the setting.
Wow.
Glorantha is a very rich, very detailed setting. And there were some concerns whether we would be able to mix those. I think Rob and I are pretty happy that we can. But the other bit is that early on we had to figure out whether our approaches to game design, because we come from very different traditions, how that would all sync. And all of these questions, you know, ended up, you know, initially being issues of worry, and it turned out to be things where, no, actually, it's not only not something that we're really worried about. I think it's going to be an overall strength for the final product. You want to add or subtract to that, Rob?
I think that from a design perspective, the two biggest challenges are one, handling what Jeff referred to about the incredible depth of Glorantha, but the fact that in the 13th Age and Glorantha product, we have to show the pillars, Orlanthus the Storm King, Arnalda is the Earth Queen, handle their myths as pillars, and then present a bunch of geography possibilities, but then we have to clear the space to allow individual campaigns to go in the directions that players' backgrounds and one unique things take them.
Right.
And that is a, and what you do is you make a setting, so that the challenge was to come up with a sort of a setting of the chaos unraveling so that people who really care deeply about all of Glorantha's background can tell themselves, oh, I'll do this and won't worry as much about the other stuff because things are falling apart. Mm-hmm. Whereas people who want to just play in the standard setting, they can't. It's like they already know it. They know it well. And here's all the tools to allow you to do that. But we're not pitching that at the newcomer so that they're supposed to learn everything. Mm-hmm. They can if they want to, but the whole point of 13th Age is you play multiple campaigns. It's like different campaigns have very, you know, different slants depending on what players want and what the direction of the game is. Mm-hmm. And that is what we're, you know, a challenge to make sure that is available to people in Glorantha. I think it's going to work out
That's part of the reason why the source book is a separate book from the rule book.
Okay.
Yep.
Right. So, because, you know, part of this is we've just finished fulfilling or in the process of fulfilling, if you live in Europe, the Guide to Glorantha, which is a remarkable book. I don't think there's anything like it in fantasy literature, let alone in the RPG industry. But it's something that, you know, we had 1,200 people spend somewhere but around $175 on average to buy this beautiful illustrated encyclopedia. They obviously are going to want to be able to use that. as the background for whatever games they do. But at the same time, there are going to be people that are coming new to this setting. They're going to want to make it their own. And so the way to that we've handled that is, you know, we have a source book, but the source book is a separate book. It's oriented towards people new to the setting, but also contains information that will make it quite interesting to people that have just bought the encyclopedia.
Right.
And so, you know, what we've tried to do is bridge that river in a way that I think works for both sides very well.
And I think that the pledge level where you get the source book, the hardback source book, as well as the hardback 13th Age of Glorantha is the most popular one.
Right, right.
Yes.
It's both of those. Now, just to be clear to listeners, is that the 13th Age in Glorantha, that's the book that gives you all the rules that you need to play in Glorantha, and the source book won't have any rules, but gives you a lot of additional information.
And it'll give you information that even if you have the Guide to Glorantha, you'll want to have this book.
Okay, so it's not just the previous Guide to Glorantha kind of, I guess, slimmed down and
not at all.
Okay, cool.
Actually, one of the big differences that you mentioned before was about how Glorantha didn't have any classes to begin with. But, of course, that's one of the core mechanics of 13th Age. How are you going to work those two systems together?
Well, the truth is that in RuneQuest, you had classes. Mm-hmm. They were, but your class was your cult.
Okay.
Okay.
So
yeah, there's a
RuneQuest 2 and classical RuneQuest 3. Well, RuneQuest 2 was even more blatant about it. You know, if you wouldn't say I'm a fighter, you'd say I'm an initiate of Humacht. But in order to progress in the cult of Humacht, you needed to build up a certain set of skills, mm-hmm. which, you know, if you squint, it looks an awful lot like a clown.
Okay. I see.
You know, there was a time when those were fighting words, Jeff Richard.
Yeah.
And I love that. I mean, I never got involved in those fights. That's not my point.
But, you know, and then with RuneQuest 3, that went even further because you picked an occupation mm-hmm. and a cult. So, okay, everybody, you know, you have, you know, what's your day job and who's your god? And again, those can pretty easily be equated to a type of class. Now, they're not the classic fighter, paladin, ranger, cleric, magic user, classes, but they can be analogized to classes.
Right.
And even Hero Quest, which is as, low rules, be whatever you want. You know, at a certain point, you've got to describe this person.
Fair
and guess what? You know, those descriptive terms that you use generally are, in HeroQuest, it's these are my three runes, and this is what I do for a living, and this is my god. And, mm-hmm. and even then, you know, that's not that hard to analogize to a classical class system.
Mm-hmm.
And so
let me go ahead and address the point directly then, because I think Jeff has set up the fact that what if you squint ways of character development in various systems, you know, they equate to classes pretty easily. But when it comes to 13th Age, in Glorantha, let's take the example of Orlanth. Characters in 13th Age in Glorantha they're worshippers of a particular god. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a character class or a big class variant for Orlanth called Windlord. And Windlord is going to be able to go in several different directions, but it's clearly a dedicated class that's like doing things that you would expect a worshiper of the storm god to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could also though play, you could play a fighter or you could play a ranger or you could play a commander and be a worshiper of Orlanth. And when you do that, one of the pieces of the book is going to be that there will be fun powers, a few, for each of those character classes that are related to Orlanth.
Hmm.
And so what that means is that if you're a commander, I'm playing a commander of Orlanth, you've got powers that nobody else has if you want them. You don't have to choose them, but you can take them. And the result of that is that there's a little bit of flavor that's new for you and a bit of a play experience that's different that makes you happy and feel special.
Yeah.
And, you know, that communicates back to regular 13th Age because you know, in your, if you want to go ahead and use these powers that are connected to Orlanth in your regular 13th Age game, all you've got to do is say which icons more or less translate to Orlanth in my 13th Age campaign. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be the Archmage and the Elf Queen, or is it going to be the Great Gold Worm and the Emperor? You know, who are the ones that equates best to in my particular campaign? And the result is that if you look overall, there's going to be an awful lot of different characters you can play, of course, mm-hmm. in 13th Age and in Glorantha. And we're going to we can't do everything in this book, but we're going to have as many options as we can to give the flavor of particular people. Mm-hmm. And, so if you want to be a dedicated healer, we all know that that's Chelana Aroy, the Lightbringer goddess who can heal anything. Mm-hmm. And that probably means there's going to be, you know, a character option for a really dedicated healer, more dedicated than it appears right now in 13th Age. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be little surprises like that, and there'll be little Easter eggs all over the place, and also just straightforward new classes to go ahead and cover concepts that are central to Glorantha or not fully covered mm-hmm. in 13th Age.
Like
now,
Earth
I don't like the Earth Queen. There's a really big example. Yes, the goddess of the Earth is exceptionally good at making people with different styles of power and different pantheons and different religions work together. And that is a style of synergistic leader that 13th Age doesn't quite have right now. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be expressed inside Glorantha in the figure of Ernalda, Orlanth's wife, also married to many other gods and goddesses, perhaps. And I'm really looking forward to the Ernaldan family as a style of player character group.
Oh, cool.
So just to clarify, it sounds like that classes in 13th Age Glorantha are going to be tied very heavily to the god that they worship, kind of like the cults that Jeff was mentioning before.
Some will be, some won't.
I mean, okay.
There will be classes that you can play because they're straight out of... Look, you can play a class straight out of 13th Age. Not a problem. Mm-hmm. And if you want to take advantage, and so then the real question is, after you do that, do you also are going to choose a god you worship? Do you want to take advantage of anything that God has to offer to your class? If the answer is no, you just want to play the class straight out of 13th Age, just go ahead. That's not a problem. Mm-hmm. So some are tied. For instance, this Ernaldan Earth Priestess class, that's a worshiper of Ernalda. And in 13th Age terms, let's say you want to take the Earth Priestess and play her in 13th Age. Odds are that she's going to need an icon relationship with the Priestess.
Right.
And possibly with the High Druid. And that's the starting point. And then after that, she can be anybody she wants to be.
Okay. Are those kind of icon conversion guides, for lack of a better term, are those going to be in 13th Age Glorantha?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the weird part about it is they're not big at all. It's a sidebar. It's a sidebar that essentially says, okay, because every 13th Age campaign is unique, you know, I can't tell you, for instance, that the Priestess is definitely the best translation in your campaign of Ernalda. I suspect it is, and here's the ranges. And so, you know, just as we've got heroic, ambiguous, and villainous icons in 13th Age, that sidebar will contain the likely translations and will also mention a couple permutations. You know, if your campaign has done this, then maybe you want to look at that instead. Mm-hmm, right. And so what it really ends up to is that players, if you're playing right 13th Age in the Dragon Empire, people have sort of been asking, like, I'll tell you, ever since playtesting started, people have been, I want some feats and powers that are connected to the Emperor mm-hmm. or the Archmage. And that has never been a design priority for me, mainly because I've just been focused on wanting to, every time I've created a good feat and been like, oh, well, that could be a feat or a spell just for the Archmage. That doesn't work that well, because it's like, I want to create things that are for the most characters possible. But 13th Age and Glorantha reverses that spin. 13th Age and Glorantha says, no, it's really, really important to support a particular god. because mm-hmm. that's what the core this mythology and this game world is about. So then when you translate that back to the Dragon Empire, then you just heard, oh, it's really, really important to go ahead and support this particular icon. And all of a sudden, the design spin has changed. And right. that's why there'll be things that are going to happen in this book that just haven't happened in 13th Age yet, but people are going to really enjoy using them in 13th Age if that's the way they want to play.
Right. I think that sums up pretty neatly my question of, yeah, because I saw on the Kickstarter page it said that 13th Age and Glorantha classes, races, and even icons are going to be sort of backwards compatible with the Dragon yep. Empire and vice versa. And I was wondering how that was going to work, since using Glorantha elements in the Dragon Empire seemed to imply that you would have to drag elements of Glorantha in there. And mm-hmm. based on that explanation, obviously you don't.
You don't. Now, there is something really fun that, Jeff, I'm going to take one moment to mention here. If the Glorantha image of hero questing, if you were actually to use it in the Dragon Empire, what you would be doing is you would be talking about legends and stories about earlier icons. The earlier, you know, not the Archmage who's alive right now.
Right.
An earlier Archmage who did this.
Fifth generation Archmage.
Yeah, exactly. And then what you have is this thing where, oh, so characters get to go ahead and participate in this mythic legendary activity that's sort of reinforcing the power of the current Archmage. You know, so, but the current Archmage isn't the guy who's in that one. It's a sort of different Archmage. And so that, just to say it, if you wanted to play that style, oh my God, does that open up a lot of powerful ground?
Really cool.
Yeah, it kind of does. And you know, I need to go ahead and write that example up just to like tell people this is how cool Glorantha is. You know, when you're playing it, mm-hmm. and this is how it feels. You know, like oh yeah, and then it's like you could also use this in the Dragon Empire. And you know what? I bet you know. Come on, somebody will.
Right.
Maybe even somebody named me. So I'm really looking forward. And that's what I mean about the cross fertilization. It's like these two worlds are their own world and they're their own thing. They don't, it's not a mashup like you get Marvel superhero, you know,
no,
Justice
this isn't
League
be
and
a
Avengers.
Marvel
no, cross. No. So it's not that kind of crossover. It's more of a cross fertilization that like they can make the different pieces stronger. So I'm pretty happy about that.
Well, for those who don't know the icon system, which is certainly front and center in 13th Age, it's chapter one. What is that? Like, how do the players interact with the icons? How does that affect them in the game?
Sure, I think I can try to explain that quickly. In fantasy worlds, there's usually these very powerful non-player characters, like a dwarf king or an elf queen or an emperor, a priestess, maybe even a prince of shadows who's in the darkness. We call those out as powerful non-player characters who definitely exist in our setting. And when players start the game, as well as creating their one unique thing and talking about what they've done in the past, which is called their backgrounds, we let them choose a relationship with between one and three of these powerful icons. And they're first level characters, so the relationship is not something that's like, you know, you can't be like, I am the personal bodyguard of the Archmage. But you can say, well, I was a personal bodyguard, you know, near the Archmage, and, you know, but I screwed up. And so, you know, I'm no longer there. And so it's sort of a conflicted relationship. Now, what that means is that during the course of the campaign, you have icon relationship roles most every session where you're finding out whether or not your connection to the icon is going to have any part in that session of play. It's kind of a free form resource and it's a tool for the game master to go ahead and interject pieces of the world that matter to you into the story. And so it's one of those ways that we bend the events of the world around what the player characters care about. If you tell me that you're a deep, deep enemy of the Diabolist, it's going to turn out that the Diabolist is showing up in the gaming campaign quite often, with you like having powers against her, being given gifts by people who hate her, also receiving information that may cause you huge amounts of trouble. Now, some of these, just to let you know, some of the not all the things that happen are just perfectly good for you. If you roll a 6 with your icon relationship die, it's really just good for you. And if you roll a 5, it's good for you and it's good for the game master. Complications ensue. We are going to use a variant of this system in 13th Age and Glorantha. Rather than just saying, all right, let's just use the same system, but, you know, scratch the names off and put in Glorantan gods, Jonathan and I are really looking at, no, let's approach this from what the perspective of what would we do if we were designing this system from the very start for Glorantha. Wow. And that answer is different than what we did in 13th Age. But it's close enough in that you're going to be able to play your 13th Age character and say, oh, do you want to use the Glorantha system this campaign? Or do you want to use the core Dragon Empire system this campaign? Or even this session? Because they're going to be the same core dice, perhaps, but a different implementation that is more in touch with what it means to be a worshiper of a Glorantan god. And I'm happy with it because I think actually that, our freeform icon system, the storytelling aspect, is something that some groups really love and other groups don't handle as well. They don't enjoy it. And so I'm pretty sure that the Glorantha version, I can just tell you, one of the design goals is the design goal is I'd rather go to Gen Con and not spend half of a gaming seminar talking about ways of interpreting and using the icon system. I think I'm going to be, people could be like, oh, cool, I get it. This is how we use it. Yes, that's great.
A lot easier to say Storm God.
I think that the freeform what we did was partially a game master. The difference, partially implemented by the game master, partially implemented by the player characters, and many tables have difficulty deciding which part should be from who. We're going to make that clearer in the Glorantha version. And in the Glorantha version, for instance, there will be probably a better phrasing of when you roll and why. And also, some of the Glorantha roles are going to mean different things. There will be some obligations imposed by one's god that will come up as a result of these roles, and that will be much clearer. And that will be a story driver. So it's going to perform the same role, which is to say driving the story. But with Glorantha, there are some things you can do with the world, and for instance, chaos. that are very different than what was happening in the Dragon Empire. So, you know, there isn't all the structure of the icons in the Dragon Empire. They're sort of like they're heroic or villainous or ambiguous. Well, that doesn't exist in Glorantha. But therefore, the opposite of strong relationships with the gods is the power of chaos increasing. Yeah. And that's something that we're actually going to bring into the game in relationship to the system, I think. So that I should say that's what we're testing, and we'll see
how we do it.
Yeah, we're testing it. And the thing is, I don't, you know, whenever you're testing something, you don't want to be like, it could happen, and it probably will.
Right.
Yep. And if it doesn't, it's going to be something related to that.
Right. So well, here to describe it makes perfect sense. The icons with Glorantha. Jeff, did you see that potential? Was that one of the things that grabbed you about the system?
Yes, that actually was one of the and as an aside, although Rob and Jonathan had for a long time, you know, were keeping in their mind and saying, you know, this could work in Glorantha. Weirdly enough, it was me that came to Rob about
that. That's true.
And in part, it was the presence of the icons is I could begin to see how this could be done.
Right.
Yeah, I think when we said that, it was like at one particular gaming session, you know, talking about, oh yeah, that would be great, but I didn't expect it, you know, sort of like, so when you said it, I was like, oh yes. and we kind of set that up too. So all right, good.
Well, actually, one of the things I'm kind of curious about, we just finished a 13th Age campaign a few weeks ago, and I played a wizard in it. So how are you planning for magic to work? In the 13G.
Magic, you say?
Well, just because, like, the, I'm blanking on the name now. The RuneQuest magic system is quite a bit different from the D&D.
Well, we're not translating RuneQuest.
Okay.
I mean, the thing about it is that we're using the 13th Age system. Mm-hmm. So that's why, in a certain sense, this is a different take on the world. You know, we're not going ahead and saying, okay, now we're going to simulate RuneQuest or simulate HeroQuest with this system. So mm-hmm. magic works just the way it does in 13th Age. Okay. You know, with possibly some new classes that implement different styles of magic that may feel, you know, right for Glorantha, but our concept of what is right for Glorantha doesn't come from how other games translated it.
What we're really trying to do is get the feel of Glorantan magic as expressed in the various stories that that Greg has written over time,
right,
without any and trying to capture, you know, how this worked in RuneQuest, how this worked in HeroQuest. I mean, mm-hmm. That's not a design parameter at all.
Right.
Oh, good.
It's not one that I've given Rob at all.
No, and it's definitely not one for, no, it isn't one we're using. Yeah. So now the funny example you used was you just played a wizard. Mm-hmm. There'll be some guidance about like character classes and how they work and, you know, how they might work in most mm-hmm. In Glorantha. Wizards feel like a very logical, very clear-cut character, and the way they feel to me most in Glorantha is they feel like Malkione, worshippers of the invisible god, you know, mm-hmm. the people who Glorantha oftentimes ends up, in a certain sense, calling sorcerers. We're not going to have a whole lot of support for the wizard class in this book for that reason, not in this book. That is not to say that they don't have a place in Glorantha. And if you want to play a wizard, well, you know, there'll be a sidebar going, here's what you do. Mm-hmm. But the wizard class, for instance, is not going to be a focus of this book. Now, the sorcerer, on the other hand, feels a lot more like, it feels a lot more like a Glorantan spellcaster to me. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be all kinds of stuff for the sorcerer in the book. Now, you know, we're not dedicated to equal treatment for classes, and we're more dedicated to let's show Glorantha in the best light we can. And then, eventually if we're able to publish more books in the line, then mm-hmm. there'll be other pieces that will come in. Not to mention that I'm helped in this by the fact that wizards already have enough stuff.
Yeah, as the one who played the sorcerer in the previous campaign, I'm fine with them getting the focus for 13G.
I know, exactly. There's certain places in the sorcerer character class where it's just like, wait a minute, my choices are what? Come on, game designer, where's the rest of my choices? And so here they come. So, yep.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, how would you describe Glorantha magic then?
Well, it's going to depend. It's going to depend on your class. Isn't that fair?
It depends on you. Oh, absolutely.
So, like an Orlanthe, if you're playing an Orlanthe Windlord, your magic is going to be in the cool feats and abilities that you have as a result of that class.
Mm-hmm. Storm, lightning, thunder, sometimes I fly. These are, you know, that your magic is an expression of, your magic is a combination of who you worship and what your class is. So when you ask me to describe what is Glorantha magic, I'm like, well,
tell me who you worship.
You gotta describe the gods, right?
Yeah, there's a point to be made though. Magic is connected to the powers of the runes. I mean, the runes are the still the fundamental building blocks of reality, but we're not attempting to be RuneQuest, and every spell doesn't have a rune component and things like that. You know, we're not trying to paste in. You're playing 13th Age. So if you've played 13th Age, you know that there's a bit of ability to go ahead and describe your spells and magic the way you want to. Right. You know, some people, like I have a player character in my group who's a cleric, and I love the fact that whenever he's casting spells, he's describing how all these various spirits, you know, of different types come and do what he wants, you know, and they'll be either running up and down his enemies, you know, or flowing out of the earth and things like that. And I think that's great. So the visuals of what's and the feel of what's happening can be up to you as it relates to like how it feels in the world. But the system's 13th Age.
Mm-hmm. And this actually models well with Greg's description of Glorantan magic in a lot of his stories. You know, and Orlanthe does his magic as a byproduct, just by being more like Orlanthe.
Yeah.
So like if there's a story that we haven't published yet, called, Harmast Saga. And in it, you know, Harmast, who's this guy who becomes one of the great Orlanthe heroes. Mm-hmm. When he does his magic, and does his Orlanthe magic, he can't really distinguish himself from his god. And so in, you know, for Orlanthe, it's actually pretty easy to work out the magic. Now, you know, there's other traditions, within Glorantha that require a different approach, like a shaman or a, I'm going to really annoy Rob because I'm going to use the Glorantan term instead of the 13th age term because I can never remember which it really is. But a Glorantan sorcerer, mm-hmm. that's a wizard, right?
Hmm. Yeah. Yep. let's not go there. Who's up first?
You know, something different as well.
Yeah.
But so it tracks pretty well. I mean, I'm very happy with it.
Here's a fun thing. Here's an example. If you've seen the 13 True Ways Druid character class, the Druid character class has 5 or 6 talents, and the Druid can. Those talents really define what powers the character gets. If you choose to be an initiate in a talent, you spent 1 talent there, and then, like, say you did elemental mastery, and you've got a few elemental mastery spells. But if you spend 2 talents to be an adept with that, you get a lot of elemental mastery spells. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be at least 1 class in the Glorantha book, I think, working on, that is the Uz class, that's going to be like that. The talents are broken out by the gods that the trolls worship, like Gorokiki, the insect god, Karg, the warrior, Kyger Lighter, mother of trolls, commander of spirits. And you can, you know, as an Uz, you're going to be able to be adept at various things, but just like the druid class, you'll get to pick which one you're going to be more involved with. Now, each of those talents even has a very different feel to them and a very different style of magic, mm-hmm. you know. If you're not initiate in Gorokiki, you're never going to be turning your mouth into giant mandibles, you know, and growing beetle wings that allow you to fly. But if you're Gorokiki, that's just what you do, and also summoning insect swarms. So, you know, so the answer is, what is Glorantha magic? Glorantha magic is whatever fits the mythological power of the god you're dealing with and the spectrum of power of the class. Oh, and what you learn on Hero Quests. Woohoo! Because one of the fun parts is going to be that, like, hey, man, if you're like an Orlanthe Windlord, but you've got to go along on that that Hero Quest that your Kyger Lighter player character in the group also, you know, is the one who's taking you along on, you may just be coming out with darkness powers you hadn't fully expected to own.
Yep.
Well, so again, we see definitely the synergy between Icons and Glorantha. It's surprising it didn't come sooner. No pressure.
Yeah. So, yeah, having just finished a 13th Age campaign, as we said, I know Lyle, as the GM, and us in general, were big fans of the simplicity of the monster write-ups. So are the monsters in 13th Age Glorantha, yeah, 13G is a lot easier to say, they presented in the same way, kind of that minimal stat block with the icon or the
stat blocks
next to them?
You didn't tell me there were going to be stat blocks, Rob.
Uh-oh.
What have you done? Oh,
Jeff. Just kidding.
If you looked at 13th Age and didn't notice the stat blocks, and that answers the question. So yes, the answer is yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm totally, there's a reason that monsters are done as simply as they are in 13th Age, and that is to make them easy to play but memorable. And that same approach needs to be used in this new game. I mean, honestly,
that's the approach that the reference documents that we give Rob very much takes as well. The reason I'm joking about stat blocks is that the various Glorantha bestiaries for HeroQuest 2 for HeroQuest Glorantha don't have any stats.
Right. Well, we've definitely got them. But our goal is we have to keep things simple, because especially when, you know, in a certain sense, if you looked at 13 True Ways is, I believe, more complex than the stuff in this book will be. because this book is, when you're introducing, this book is an introduction of Glorantha to 13th Age players and an introduction of 13th Age to Glorantha fans. Okay. Ergo, we can't be as complex as we were in 13 True Ways. 13 True Ways was me and Jonathan just going, oh man, let's do the crazy stuff we really want to do for 13th Age. And well, yeah, no, that this book doesn't have that same mandate. This book is not like, do the crazy thing that you think really needs to be done because no one's done it. This book is partly an introduction. And therefore, although I'm sure there'll be a couple of things on the complex side, the goal is to, the goal is if we come up with really, really great mechanics that happen to be, you know, complicated for a monster, it's like, well, maybe that's, you know, not what we do, because the point, you know, we could do it a few times, but the point has got to be to keep most things on the simple side, in terms of how they play. Now, that's a design challenge, because what the goal is making things fun and exciting while still being easy to parse. And, that's what I want. You know, I like, you want to be able to, as a game master, to run things quickly, and that's going to be really important for what I expect to be people who haven't necessarily run it before with this book.
Right.
So, yep. Now, that same kind of thing might extend to player characters, and when it doesn't, there'll be little warnings. So, there will be some, I'm not going to say what it is, but there are some things that Glorantha monsters add to the system that will be, I hope, simple and fun, that haven't been seen by monsters from regular 13th Age.
Oh, so, okay.
The trick there is just that instead of being added complexity, what that is has to, quote, has to be the complexity for that monster.
Hmm.
So, that's going to be fun. And that'll be it'll be something added that hasn't been seen yet. And I'm excited about that. So,
okay.
And I'm not going to spoil that one.
All right. No scoops.
Yeah. No, well, there are maybe scoops, but not that one.
Well, it might be too early to ask about future products, because, I mean, you've got two right now that are coming out next year, 13th Age Glorantha and the Glorantha Sourcebook. But can we expect to see more? I mean, I think you've hinted at a magic book, but maybe I'm just wishing.
I believe they used books in the plural sense.
Jeff, you first.
Well, should we talk about one that we know we're interested in doing?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. That's what I mean. Talk about the one we know we're interested in.
We are definitely doing a big adventure pack.
Ooh, cool.
And what we want to do is we've got two adventure pack areas in mind, and we're still debating about it. But one is the Upland Marsh. Which is this area in Dragon Pass that's ruled by Delecti the Necromancer, filled with zombies and vampiric...
Undead killer whales.
Oh, sweet.
Yep.
Crazy
anything
stuff.
Anything dead has been animated to be used to defend this. And this is a big reason why ducks are ultimately tolerated in Dragon Pass, is the very existence of this place. And Rob and Ash and I have been talking about that. And then you want to talk about the other one we were talking about? No decisions have been made on either.
Okay.
Rob?
Yeah. No, you should.
Well, the other one is, and something I think would work extraordinarily well with 13th Age, as would Upland Marsh and Delecti, but would be doing a new and different treatment of Snakepipe Hollow. And Snakepipe Hollow was a classic RuneQuest dungeon crawl that had a lot of mythic elements, but there's a lot more that can be done with it. And the original Snakepipe Hollow issue, adventure involving the Caves of Chaos basically just scratched at the surface of the horrible wrongness that is Snakepipe Hollow. And this is something that I always loved. The area of Snakepipe Hollow. I've done lots of weird hero quest and rune quest adventures going there. There's a huge amount of material that's never been published about it, as well as there's a lot of just awesome dungeon crawling opportunities there that haven't been seen in any form for 30 years. And I would very much love to be able to do an adventure pack in either of those, or even better, in both of those.
And so what's going on is that we're in the middle of the Kickstarter. We had no idea when we started the Kickstarter how well it would do. Right. One of the couple of things we have to figure out is whether or not any of these plans are relevant to the Kickstarter. We're not certain about that yet, because, you know, they're not really plans. They're more like, oh, man, we really want to do that. And when we see that the Kickstarter is being as popular as it is, and we kind of, I mean, and I kind of know that this is a book, when you're doing an intro book that's an introduction to two audiences who don't know something, the sign that it's doing well now, it'll probably do better once it's out in a weird way, because people are like, yeah. Oh, yeah, this is good. Aha, okay. And so at that stage, just like, yeah, probably you can do adventures. And so the question mark is, what is the timing for that? And simultaneously, you know, if the Kickstarter does well enough and then we do well enough with a book, boy, there are things, you know, for instance, I thought long and hard about whether or not dragon newts were something to push as player characters.
Right.
Because I have mechanical ideas for it, and I think it'd be really fun, and
oh,
I think
it would
be great. But the scope of the myths and the scope, you know, we're doing this playable myth approach. The scope of the myths that we would need to, like, add to the game and how we would, that treatment just indicates, you know what? They're not, it's outside the scope of what we would want to do with the book we're doing right now.
Right.
So what does that mean? Well, what I hope it means is that, you know, we get to do them later, you know, as part of a really exciting book that involves them and a couple of the other things that we didn't get to. Mm-hmm. Like your mall, the trickster, another piece that I really would love to do right, but I don't think we don't have time or scope to do that. No matter what happens with the Kickstarter, because you just don't want to, like, try.
We don't make, we're not going to do another Guide to Glorantha size book.
Right.
Yeah, you gotta cut things off at some point and be like, well, that would be a great thing to do, but the amount of pages and effort it would require to do it really, really well indicates that it wouldn't happen in a time frame that would make sense. Right. And so therefore, that is the other piece. So there's adventures, and yes, and then there's more things that could be part of a source book, because there's just too much in Glorantha that's fun, you know, and we're just, like, focusing on Dragon Pass right now. So even inside, you know, just within the Dragon Pass and the stuff right around it, not to mention, I mean, oh my God, Lunars. they are the enemy in this book. Mm-hmm. Just like the focus is laser tight on the idea that no, the Lunars and Chaos are the enemy. However, if, you know, people end up playing this game for years and liking it, then, well, at some point,
there has to be a Lunar.
That's rich, fertile ground. So, yeah.
Because the Lunars are awesome.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Well, here's to hoping that happens.
Yeah.
I just remember my Dragon Pass game and all the little chits, the Duckman, the Dragon Newts, and the Lunars.
Ha-ha!
All of them.
Oh, that's a conversation for another day. because we could have a big one on that one.
That's right.
More teasers. All right.
Well, I think that pretty much covers what we've got. Is there anything extra you guys want to add?
Well, I want to thank you guys for your time and giving us this opportunity to talk with you all. And we want to thank everybody that's been backing this Kickstarter so far. We've got we're a little bit over halfway through it. Mm-hmm. And we're very, very excited about what product we're going to be coming out with, given how successful it's already been.
Yeah, we want to say thank you to you guys as well. We enjoyed everything about this recording, and we really love the game of 13th Day that we just played, and we're, of course, all fans of Glorantha, so we're looking forward to every piece of this. So, yeah, thank you very much for coming on.
Awesome.
Great. All right.
And if I could just give a recommendation, is go for the printed books, because they're gorgeous.
This will have the same level of quality that we insist on having.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Cool.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Right. Thanks much.
Thank you.
Cool.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idlerdhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time. Bye.
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 drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.